I'm Tommy McNeil. Cambodians voted Sunday in the country's sixth election since the fall of the Khmer Rouge, a contest that has continued to be marred by serious irregularities right into its final moments. This is one of the voters who headed to the polls.
No matter which party wins, I hope the Cambodian people can unite together and the country can progress. Everyone would have a job, the salaries would go up, and living standards would be improved. I hope that our living standard can catch up with our neighboring countries.
And there is little doubt that the country's ruling Cambodian People's Party will win the ballot in a landslide following the dissolution of the only viable opponent, the Cambodian National Rescue Party, late last year. Shortly after polls opened Sunday, Prime Minister Hun Sen, who has ruled for 33 years, arrived at his local station that many rights groups and observers say signals the death knell for democracy in Cambodia. U.S. President Donald Trump threatened Sunday to shut down the government if Congress does not fund construction of a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border to thwart illegal immigration. The U.S. leader claimed opposition Democrats need to give him the vote for the border security, which includes the wall and other tougher national immigration policy changes. But it was a splintered Republican majority bloc of lawmakers, along with unified Democratic opposition, that twice in recent weeks rejected immigration changes Mr. Trump supported. Trump's threatened government shutdown would come as spending authorization runs out again at the end of the current fiscal year, at the end of September, about 5 weeks before the nationwide congressional elections on November 6th. This is VOA News. A powerful 6.4 magnitude earthquake struck the popular tourist island of Lombok in Indonesia on Sunday. More than a dozen people injured and killed, I should say. David Doyle reports.
At least a dozen people lost their lives after a powerful earthquake struck on Lombok, a popular tourist destination near Bali in Indonesia, sending villagers fleeing from their homes into open fields to avoid collapsing buildings.
It happened so suddenly at around 6 in the morning. Suddenly everything simply collapsed. My child was inside the house. Thankfully, he survived.
An emergency tent has been set up to treat the injured as the local hospital was damaged, and electricity was cut off around the slopes of Mount Rinjani, a busy trekking destination. The 6.4 magnitude quake could also be felt strongly on the west side of Bali. Earthquakes are common in Indonesia because it's located on the seismically active Ring of Fire.
That's David Doyle's reporting for Reuters. Zimbabwe's former president, Robert Mugabe, says Zimbabweans have not been free since the de facto army coup that deposed him from office last year. It was not immediately clear what he meant by that statement. Mugabe is holding a surprise news conference at his residence on the eve of the country's first election since he was ousted from office. The former president said the November coup was not necessary because he had planned to step down from office in December. A Palestinian teenager who was videotaped last year slapping two Israeli soldiers has been released from prison. Robert Berger reports for VOA.
Seventeen-year-old Palestinian Ahed Tamimi got a hero's welcome in the West Bank after she was released from an Israeli prison. Tamimi served 8 months for slapping and kicking an Israeli soldier. A video of the assault went viral on social media and turned her into a protest icon.
That's Robert Berger reporting for VOA News. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is vowing not to back down to Washington's demand to release American pastor Andrew Brunson, who is on trial on terrorism-related charges. U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday threatened severe sanctions if Brunson is not released. The Turkish president is currently on a tour of African countries. Erdogan's comments coincide with an escalation of anti-U.S. rhetoric. Fried pro-government newspaper Sunday all carried out the same headline, "We are not tied from our stomachs." I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Those other factions, within the opposition movement, will not have enough critical mass and gravitas to deprive Nelson Chamisa of the majority. But that is wishful thinking.
Zimbabweans go to the polls to choose their new president Monday.
The president has only been in power since 2015, so he's only been in power for 3 to 4 years. So yes, the president has done a lot of work since he's been president for the city of Lusaka.
Residents of the Zambian capital Lusaka elect Miles Sampa as the city's new mayor.
These are political executions. I don't think they will be carried out. The only cases where executions were carried out were direct attacks on the military that resulted in killings.
And an Egyptian court asked top Islamic religious leader to review death sentences for people condemned over a deadly Muslim Brotherhood sit-in. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabweans go to the polls on Monday to choose their new president. President Emmerson Mnangagwa from the ruling ZANU-PF faces a stiff challenge from the leader of the main opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance in their presidential election. The presidential vote will be the first time Zimbabweans vote without former President Robert Mugabe on the ballot. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission says it is ready to administer free, fair and credible elections despite concerns of voter intimidation and possible violence. For the latest development, I read Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst in the capital, Harare.
The atmosphere is upbeat. People are excited. But of course, they're going to find the old issue about the ballot paper security and undefined movements of, that commissioners and so forth. But generally, when you are tracking the mood of the people, everybody seems to be ready.
But Rejoice, this will be the first time since 1980 that Zimbabwe had its independence from former colonial power Britain to choose a leader apart from Robert Gabriel Mugabe. How are people reacting to this?
Well, it's going to be very interesting when you get into the polling booth, voting booth, to see the conspicuous absence of Robert Mugabe and, of course, Morgan Tsvangirai. And that, to me, has been that kind of ingredient that was needed to steer young Zimbabweans. Because remember, young Zimbabweans had always been complaining that this legacy of revolutionaries and the war is irritating us. So it's really exciting for this young generation, who, by the way, are the highest number of registered voters. In fact, they have never voted before. So it's bound to be an experience that will require a lot of documenting.
As an observer, an analyst, and a Zimbabwean, do you think these political parties, particularly the ruling ZANU-PF party, Emmerson Mnangagwa, and Nelson Chamisa of the MDC Alliance, made their case to prospective voters who go to the polls to choose their new leader tomorrow?
Absolutely. You know, when Nelson Chamisa yesterday was commenting that this is his 84th rally, you could sense that even if Morgan Tsvangirai had been there himself, he would not been able to handle it. And then you look at the brand presence of Mnangagwa, billboard, television adverts, radio adverts, these online visibility, the number of rallies he has. You can literally sense the palpable atmosphere that the manifestos, as they were presented on paper, these two gentlemen have been able to present them, and there are very, very few issues that have not been responded to in radio talk shows and people phone in, and you can sense that the message seems to have come home.
Nelson Chamisa, the main opposition leader from the MDC Alliance, has expressed confidence that he will win the election. But do you think he has what it takes, particularly when the ruling ZANU-PF party machinery is still at play? People are complaining about possible violence, voter intimidation, and all that.
Look, you've done well to actually, observe that the ruling party machinery is still intact. But remember, here we are talking about another machinery that is still intact, the Mugabe machinery. Mugabe could have been deported in November last year, but his structures are still intact. So insofar as, the MDC alliance has to worry and be anxious about the machinery of the ruling party, Mnangagwa will have also to be worried about the residual Mugabe element that might get back at him on the ballot paper. But you are right, the critical edge that Mnangagwa and ZANU-PF have is their dominance over state institutions and other electoral management bodies. So that, to me, of course, it will not give him a majority, but the possibility of a runoff is very distinct here.
I understand some Zimbabweans are expressing worry that ZANU-PF could possibly not be dislodged because of the division and not a single candidate representing all the opposition parties to challenge President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his ZANU-PF party. What impact do you think this would have in tomorrow's elections?
Well, there is a kind of deja vu, because I remember distinctly in 2008 when Simba Makoni took a number of votes from Morgan Tsvangirai, 8-10%, and that was enough to deprive Morgan Tsvangirai of a 50% percent plus one. But I still maintain, I could be wrong, my point is that Mnangagwa also has his own fractures and divisions to worry about within ZANU-PF. It would have worked wonders if the opposition vote was united. But one just assumes that perhaps that those other factions within the opposition movement will not have enough critical mass and gravitas to deprive Nelson Chamisa of the majority. But that is wishful thinking, because we have been down that route before, and the votes have disappeared before. So it's a very, very sad prospect indeed.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Meanwhile, Zimbabweans go to the polls Monday without its founding leader Robert Mugabe on the ballot. For VOA, Sebastian Mihofu in the Zimbabwean capital Harare filed this report on the role of the ousted president in the campaign.
I, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, do swear that I'll be faithful.
That was Robert Mugabe in 1980. Taking the oath as Zimbabwe's first leader after independence. He was to be the country's head for the next 37 years until November last year, when military pressure led him to resign. Until his sudden address to reporters this Sunday, Mugabe had been largely quiet, except in March when he said his successor, Emmerson Mnangagwa, had taken power through a coup. On Sunday, he said he would not vote for Mnangagwa and ZANU-PF, a party he formed in the 1960s. Jealous Mawarire of the National Patriotic Front, a party which is largely associated with the First Family and organized the Sunday address, says the 94-year-old former leader still has a role to play.
Is a very, very important factor in the sense that there are millions of people who were within ZANU-PF who respected him and believed in his pro-people policies.
While during the election campaign, President Mnangagwa has avoided mentioning Mugabe, his ZANU-PF party has said the main opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa, of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, is the one closest to the former president. In his final rally Saturday, Chamisa said he talks to Mugabe, but there's no reason for the ruling ZANU-PF party to disown his old man.
We understand Mugabe vane zvavakatadza. But pavaitadza, vaitadza.
He says, we understand that Mugabe was wrong in some of his actions, but he was not alone. He was with Mnangagwa. But that is not my focus. The focus is not the past. The focus is the future. He adds, past mistakes we correct, past omissions we remedy, past omissions we relieve. But when we move forward, we ask those who ruled first where they went wrong. That is how we solve things as we are moving forward. ZANU-PF supporters are divided about Mugabe. Everson Chimungungu from Epworth, just outside Harare, had this to say. When I think of Mugabe's time, we had become slaves. Housing stands were taken away from us, he adds. This was painful and is still very painful to us. We feel that is not good, he added. Zvichemo Womani from Mutoko, about 200 kilometers east of Harare, says, I don't want to hear about Mugabe because I'm now 48 years old and I feel that he is responsible for who I've become because I've never worked in my life. And 73-year-old Helen Katandika from Akshura's mining farming area just outside Harare, who says she will vote for Mnangagwa this Monday. During the Mugabe era, we were living quite well here because we have our land. We are fairly outsiders when it comes to whether Mugabe's rule was good or bad. It was amongst his colleagues in Harare who saw that he was old and needed him to retire. While the ZANU-PF party might try to disown Mugabe, Alexander Rusero, a senior lecturer of journalism and international politics at Harare Polytechnic College, says this election is crucial for Mnangagwa.
ZANU-PF is trying to legitimize itself because, by and large, what happened after the oust of Robert Mugabe, you have a government that has got questionable legitimacy, political legitimacy, which this government desperately needs. The Emmerson Mnangagwa-led administration is in desperate need of endorsement to say at least we are governing through the consent of the people, through the consent of the electorate. So this election is equally important to them should they win it, because it will clear the dark episodes of what happened in November.
Results of Monday's first post-Mugabe general election are expected by Saturday. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Zambian capital Lusaka has a new mayor, Miles Samper. This after the Electoral Commission declared him the winner in a landslide, 80,000 votes against slightly over 36,000 for his rival. Samper, from the ruling Patriotic Front Party, or PF, defeated main challenger Ingwa Chilishi of the opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. The mayoral seat became vacant after the death of incumbent Wilson Kalumba. I spoke to the newly elected mayor, Miles Samper, and asked him about his vision for the future and how he plans to fund his campaign promises to voters.
I was very lucky. Our depot position, because I'm backed by the ruling party, the Patriotic Front, PF, and also backed by the president of Zambia, who is the leader of that party. And so they all went flat out. He went flat out to campaign for me as if we were underdogs. So we didn't leave any stone untouched. We went to all the seven constituencies of Lusaka and all the slums or compounds of Lusaka, which are densely populated, and sowed ourselves, and more so that the president has performed, and these new roads in the compounds, tarred roads, new health hospitals and all that. So we had a saying with the president when we go there, I would say Sonta. Sonta is a local word that means point at. So we're asking the opposition to point at what they have done, because my president was pointing at the tar roads and new hospitals that he has done. So that made it easy.
What is your vision for residents of Lusaka and those who will come to visit Lusaka?
My vision is to make the council responsive and respond to the aspirations and needs of Lusaka residents. But with that, ultimately, I plan to turn the city into a garden city. I plan to make Lusaka City clean and make it green. So it starts from there. I want to make Lusaka better. I promise that within 100 days, I'll start removing all piles of garbage because they're all over the city, piles of garbage not collected by the council because it was moribund, not collected for a couple of months. So there's mountains of garbage. So immediately, I've already started working on that promise so that Lusaka is clean.
How do you plan to fund this initiative? Because it will take money to do that. What plan do you have to fund it, and what budget will you have to do so?
I'm guided by the vision of the party and of the president and the manifesto of our party, PF. The president has already started doing a lot of things in that line, so I'm just joining in to as a driver of the council bus that has had no driver since the late mayor died a few months ago. So I'm just going there and start to put the bus, the council, on speed cruise. Now, the question of where will the finance come from? I've been asked that question so many times by the residents during this campaign and debate. But I've told them that in my world, there's no impossibilities. And we will find the money. I believe the council has huge potential for finances, but the money wasn't getting in the council coffers. The first thing I'll do is stop income leakage to the council. So all the money that belongs to the council and wasn't being paid to the council, I'll make sure it's received. Simple things like if you own a dog, by law, we're supposed to be paying a fee to the council, but nobody bothers to pay it. So I'll demand for that money. If you own a firearm, you need to pay license fee yearly to the council. I'll demand for that money and make sure that people pay. People make plans extending their homes as they please. I've seen people making shops by their homes and extending their homes without council approval. So I'll go in, give them amnesty, but they need to pay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar.
Now, Miles, you spoke about the concerns of garbage and other issues that the city is faced with. Critics of yours are saying the ruling party, the Patriotic Front, is to blame because they are in charge of government and that the head of government, President Edward Chagwalungu, is in Lusaka. Because Lusaka is where business is done by the international community when they come to negotiate and interact and do business with the government. And so the PF is to be blamed for the problems that Lusaka faces. How do you react to such criticisms?
Yes, indeed. Bear in mind that most of these problems of the city of Lusaka are historical. The president has only been in power since 2015, so he's only been in power for 3 to 4 years. So, yes, the president has done a lot of work since he's been president for the city of Lusaka. For instance, he's given away popularity with the youth just to make that Lusaka is orderly. What he's doing is building modern markets for them, and they've been asked to go inside the markets and not trade along the streets. Even during this campaign, some youths tried to take advantage and go back in the streets to start selling their merchandise. He was categorical. So were we that, no, we may as well lose a few votes, but we are determined to make Lusaka orderly in terms of law and order and also make merchandise only be traded in the market.
Miles Sampa is the newly elected mayor of the Zambian capital, Lusaka. He spoke with me from Lusaka. This week, the leaders of the BRICS economic grouping met in Johannesburg, South Africa. Its members include 5 of the world's largest emerging national economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They represent over 40% of the world's population and say their integration and cooperation could vastly boost Africa's economic growth. Cyril Prinsloo is a researcher in the Economic Diplomacy Program at the South African Institute of International Affairs in Johannesburg. My colleague William Eagle asked him why BRICS is now supporting free trade and many elements of the global trading system when some countries once defended tariffs to protect and grow their own local industries.
literally from the outset of BRICS cooperation, they've maintained their support for the multilateral trading system, maintained support for the WTO, increasing protectionism from the U.S. has been a key issue of discussion amongst the BRICS, especially this year. And I think, importantly, you know, it stands to the detriment of not only the BRICS, but genuinely of all countries globally, right? For South Africa, of course, we know that for our automotive industry, for aluminium and steel industry, you know, already we've been hearing signs that it's been negatively impacting us. So certainly this was a major point of discussion for the BRICS.
Are the BRICS now embracing the international so-called liberal economic order, something that they once denounced because it actually marginalized African economies?
All of the BRICS are committed to the WTO. I think they've been very vocal in support of the Doha Development Round, concluding the round, ensuring that the commitments made by developed countries ahead of the Doha Round are actually realized. But at the same time, one has to keep in mind that these are developing countries, right? So when they advocate for what we refer to as policy space, of course, one can view it as being protectionist, but at the same time, you know, many of these countries still have infant industries as they look to grow to ultimately be competitive on international markets. So I think there's a very fine balance between trade restrictive measures and what many developing countries are calling for in terms of policy space.
African countries welcome Chinese and Indian investment, including loans. And yet, over the past several years, other countries have complained that the Chinese hire their own people and not Africans for development projects, and that African countries could also head back into debt with Chinese loans, as they did years ago with Western loans. Was this brought up at the BRICS talks, and how big an issue is that?
Some of the BRICS members, including China, India, and South Africa, have become key infrastructure financiers on the continent. As with everything else, there is a good and a bad to it. On the one hand, it helps African countries to diversify its sources of financing. But as you rightly pointed out, it's also brought some challenges. Certainly, the debt issue is something that we expected would be high on the agenda. So many of the African leaders meeting with the BRICS counterparts, you know, we have been seeing over the last couple of years rising debt stocks in African countries. And I think a key part of the discussion should be around the transparency of loans. You know, and this goes for all financiers, for all African countries, to ensure that, you know, when countries engage in financing, that there's transparency, which will help inform all vendors on a country's position.
Is there any evidence so far that BRICS initiatives have indeed boosted African economies among its members?
Absolutely. I mean, one can measure, you know, there's been a significant increase in trading relations between all of these countries. Clearly, that's something we can measure. The same goes with investment. Now, having said that, and I'm talking here about intra-BRICS investment, we haven't seen as much intra-BRICS investment as probably we would have wanted over the past decade. To give you an example, South Africa actually has more foreign direct investment in China than China has in South Africa, and that's according to the end of 2016 statistics. However, as you rightly pointed out, we have again this year seen a number of announcements on investments. We've seen last year a number of Chinese investments realized in South Africa, which is certainly encouraging.
Over the next year or two, are there any particular challenges that the BRICS countries will likely confront?
Short term, certainly protectionism, maintaining the rules-based trading system will be a key challenge for all of the BRICS, really. I think in the kind of mid to long term, another key issue that was high on the agenda, of course, this year was the impact of technology in the BRICS countries, specifically on the economies, manufacturing, production. You know, for South Africa, of course, we have very high unemployment, which is a key challenge for us. The challenges that new technological innovations will have on that is not yet known.
Cyril Prinsloo is a researcher in the Economic Diplomacy Program at the South African Institute of International Affairs in Johannesburg. He spoke with my colleague William Eagle. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, an Egyptian court has asked the country's top Islamic religious leader, the Mufti of the Republic, to review death sentences for people condemned over a deadly Muslim Brotherhood sit-in, which the army quashed in 2013. More than 600 people were reportedly killed in the incident. A number of prominent Muslim Brotherhood leaders are among the 75 people sentenced to death, although the majority were judged in absentia. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Muhammad Ibrahim al-Biltaqi, Hisam al-Din Muhammad Hussein al-Aryan.
Arab media reports that an Egyptian court has asked the country's mufti to review death sentences handed down to 75 people involved in a 2013 Muslim Brotherhood sit-in camp outside the Rabah Adawiya Mosque in northern Cairo. The sit-in was stormed by the Egyptian military after the Brotherhood refused to evacuate the camp. Official reports put the death toll at close to 700 people. It was not immediately clear why the case was remanded to the Mufti, although some commentators suggest it was related to the 5-year anniversary of the government's quashing of the Muslim Brotherhood sit-in. Two prominent Muslim Brotherhood leaders, Mohammed Baltaghi and Hisam al-Aryan, were among those condemned to death, along with Tariq Azumar and Hisam Abdelmagid of the Gamaa al-Islamiyya movement. 44 of the people condemned to death were judged in absentia, meaning that new trials must be carried out if and when they are captured or return voluntarily to Egypt. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA he does not think the men who were condemned are likely to be put to death, given the controversial nature of the charges against them.
These are political executions. I don't think they will be carried out. The only cases where executions were carried out were direct attacks on the military that resulted in killings. So the sit-ins in Rabah al-Adawiyya in 2013 remain highly controversial, and nobody in the world, not even inside Egypt, takes these sentences seriously.
Kashan says the Egyptian government may be trying to mend its relations with the Muslim Brotherhood, but on its own terms. He points out that Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who was re-elected to a second 4-year term in March, would like his ousted predecessor, Mohamed Morsi, to recognize his government, since that would finally and officially legitimize his regime. Kashan doubts, however, the Muslim Brotherhood would be willing to make such a concession. Former Muslim Brotherhood politician Amr Darag claimed in a tweet Saturday that the Sisi government considers the unfreezing of U.S. military aid to Egypt a green light for the death sentences, and that the U.S. administration will have the blood of these innocent victims on its hands. The Trump administration unfroze $195 million in military aid to Egypt this past week. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia beat Mbabane Swallows of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, 2-0 on Friday to become the first club to reach the quarterfinals of this season's Africa Champions League. Goals from Maha Hanachi and Slim Ben Belgachem gave Etoile the victory, with the Tunisians also missing a first-half penalty through Alaya Brigou. Etoile, the 2007 African champions, extend their lead in Group D to 10 points, sealing a place in the last eight with two group games to spare. Only the group winners and runners-up qualify for the Champions League quarterfinals. Primeiro Agosto of Angola will fancy their chances of finishing second in Group D behind Etoile after they snatched a last-gasp 2-1 victory over ZESCO United of Zambia in Luanda on Friday. Victory lifts Primeiro from the last in the group, second on 5 points, a point ahead of third-place Swallows. Elsewhere on Friday, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa hauled themselves back into contention for a place in the quarterfinals with a 2-1 home win over Porto of Togo in Group C. In another match played on Friday, Morocco's Difa Al Jadida held former champions Entet Satif of Algeria to a 1-1 draw at home in Group B. Also on Saturday in Group A, Tunisia's Premier League side Esperance Sportive du Tunis stopped host KCCA FC of Uganda 1-0 at the Nelson Mandela Stadium in Kampala. Substitute Haitham Juni netted the winner in the 40th minute from a cross by Gilane Chalali. The winner over the 10-man KCCFC, who had goalkeeper Charles Lukwago sent off, takes Esperance to 10 points in the group and close qualifying for the quarterfinal stage. Egypt's Al Ahly and Township Rollers FC of Botswana are the other teams in Group A. Elsewhere, Africa's two representatives at next month's Under-20 Women's World Cup, Nigeria and Ghana, have named strong squads for the finals in France. The ever-present Falconets will be participating at their 9th straight tournament, while it will be a 5th consecutive appearance for the Black Princesses. Runners-up at the 2010 and 2014 events, Nigeria will open against Germany in Group D on August 6th, before games against debutants Haiti and tricky China. Ghana will play the host France in the first match on August 5th, before Group A fixtures against the Netherlands 3 days later and New Zealand on August 12th. And finally, the IAAF has announced that Nairobi in Kenya will host the 2020 IAAF World Athletics Under-20 Championships. Nairobi's candidacy was formally endorsed by the IAAF Council in Buenos Aires on Friday. By hosting an outstanding final edition of the World Under-18 Championships last year, Nairobi demonstrated its readiness to take the next step as the championship host. IAAF President Sebastian Coe noted the Kenyan government's strong support for the Nairobi bid and said it would be an ideal host for the championships. The World Under-20 Championships, Nairobi 2020, have been scheduled for July 7th to 12th. And that's about it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Kamuna nipenda sana umarufwe kambale lele nyumba ya mama ivyo usiwaze madale siwe kesho madrama pigiwa simu na tale testa na tukanwa umeshanzisha kware umi moyo wangu wepesi kupenda na mgumu kusamu moyo wangu nateseka sana na impenda kindarau Baila, 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 baila
kivita ataki niendele. If you keep a nafasi tafadhali niombe. Na nyumbani visa ndugu zangu wazoe. Itaniumiza nafsi ikifike muzionge. Na mashemeji kufisi mnapocheka nao tahadhari sana. Sunajua na mziki vitabia vyo wamejawa tama. Na dada zangu mawifi chunga nyendo zao usipele kwe mrama. Wakikumbia kaniki mara chota nyayo jumume unakuama. Utawapigiji ikutafuna usimeze roda. Ongeza tubigi kunikuna sio kuniroga. Kunikomba zaidi pika nguna ntaleta mboga. Unipenda kabibi kwa tusuna shushe na soda. Oni moyo wangu wepesi kupenda na mgumu kusamu. Moyo wangu nateseka sana na impenda kimbarau. Moyo wangu odari kugawa wakunipa sina. Moyo wangu numana na sisi tisa usijana.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The 10th BRICS summit, which convened and ended in Johannesburg last week, was far more significant than many could have predicted, particularly for the African continent. The meeting convened during the centenary of the birth of Nelson Mandela. And the theme of the conference was BRICS in Africa, collaboration for inclusive growth and shared principle prosperity in the fourth industrial revolution. The context of the meeting itself was significant. It came at a time when the norms and principles for the conduct of international relations were being challenged all throughout the last few years. And one aspect of this challenge is the ongoing trade war. Africa was the theme because the host, South Africa, made special effort to extend the conference to many non-African members of BRICS. 9 heads of state of Africa were invited to participate as observers. In addition, many other heads of states of outside Africa and international institutions attended as observers. It is very important for all African trade ministries and foreign ministries to get hold of the documents of this conference and to study them because they are extremely significant, very rich in things that Africa could learn from. Because the trend now in international relations could end in a version which could be negative or adverse to the African continent. The participants in the conference, particularly Russia, India, Brazil, all seized the opportunity of this conference to expand and strengthen their ties with the African continent. India, for example, held bilateral conference with many African countries prior to the meeting and during the meeting. And the Prime Minister of India announced that India would open 13 new embassies in the African continent. Similarly, Russia, which had left Africa at the end of the Cold War, showed clear sign of returning to the African continent. President Putin not only signed significant agreement with South Africa and many other African countries, he announced that Russia will hold a new African-Russian summit. Significance of the African country also to Russia. And the president of Turkey, which had just won a marvelous victory in Turkey, was present at the conference as observer. Hitherto, Turkey has been expanding its relations in East Africa and the Horn of Africa, but it shows signs of now dealing with the African continent. The reason why Africans should study these documents is because these trade wars and also the frequent use of sanctions may come to hurt the African continent. For example, South Africa has become a collateral victim of the trade war, even though it was not a target of the trade war. And in the case of sanctions, Africans are going to be targeted with secondary sanctions if they fail to abide by sanctions by the major powers. Now, there has been some subtle campaign to warn Africans to be aware of China. But gratefully, many African states are not falling into the trap because they could see the major difference between the colonial period and China's activities in the continent. For example, in the area of infrastructure building, China has been doing tremendous work. During the colonial period, there was hardly any major infrastructure development except those that lead from community areas to the ports by railroads. So Africans should be also ready to exploit this opportunity. Thus far, South Africa has been exploiting it, trying to develop its trade relations with China and other BRICS members and encouraging more and more investment. Similarly, Rwanda have been trying to do the same, following the footsteps of South Africa. And statements made by the president of Uganda showed that Uganda also wants to do it. So this is why this BRIC conference was so important, and that is why Africans have been asked to study this document and to see how they can synchronize their policy with the aims and objectives that are all outlined in the Declaration of Johannesburg relating to this 10th summit of BRICS. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Patrick Deya, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if a lizard decides to wear trousers, it should know where to put the tail. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwe's most vulnerable children will be getting some additional help from the United States. On July 16th, the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced the launch of Pathways, a five-year, $35 million program that will offer services to 250,000 HIV-affected orphans and vulnerable children, 59,500 households, and 15,000 vulnerable youth. Operating in 9 districts in Zimbabwe with a high HIV burden, Pathways will put communities on a road to self-reliance by building capacity in local institutions. These will then be able to provide a comprehensive set of services that improve the health, nutrition, and psychosocial well-being of HIV-affected and infected children. Funded by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, through USAID, Pathways will be implemented by Catholic Relief Services in collaboration with key stakeholders, including the Ministry of Labor and Social Welfare, the Ministry of Health and Child Care, the Ministry of Primary and Secondary Education, Child Protection Services, and others. Although much progress has been made in the past decade, HIV remains one of the top health threats facing the people of Zimbabwe. Since 2000, over 1.2 million adults have died from AIDS, leaving 16% of Zimbabwean children without one or both of their parents. The United States, through PEPFAR, supports life-saving treatment for nearly 1 million Zimbabweans living with HIV. For more than 30 years, the American people, through USAID, have contributed over $3 billion in assistance to Zimbabwe. Current projects include initiatives to increase food security, support economic resilience, improve health systems and services, and promote democratic governance. The United States is proud to work with public and private sector partners in Zimbabwe to better protect the health and well-being of Zimbabwe's vulnerable children.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.